Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch, the editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I am joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you guys today?
Exhausted.
Yeah.
I'm pretty good.
Okay. Before we get started on this week's potentially jumbo-sized show, I want to tell you a bit about RebellerMedia.com. RebellerMedia.com is a one-stop shop for all your film writing needs. Every day, I and my crack team of editors will be gathering the most interesting movie news and essays on the web for you to browse through. Think of us a bit like the Drudge Report for Hollywood. After you're done checking out the day's headlines, we hope you will stick around and enjoy some Rebeller originals. In the coming weeks, we're going to have S. Craig Zoller talking about some of his favorite graphic novels, and an essay from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood editor Fred Raskin on Sally Benke, the steady editing hand behind Quentin Tarantino's rise to prominence. The great Matt Labash will weigh in on Marvel vs. Marty, and Rebeller's own Dave Spielman will be lighting fires on the reg. We are paying good people good money for the content you're enjoying, including the content you're enjoying right now. And we hope you'll sign up for a membership, which will give you unlimited access. It's either $2 a month or $20 for the whole year. It's very, very affordable, and you will be doing a good deed. Now, on to the show. Up first is Controversies and Nontroversy. Angst has roiled the world of media with the release of Richard Jewell. We'll review Clint Eastwood's new film in a moment, but first let's take at the most controversial aspect of the film, or possibly the most non-controversial aspect of the film, the depiction of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's Kathy Scruggs as a woman who slept with sources. This has long been a bugbear of the critical left, who find the trope to be deeply unfeminist. Similar outcries occurred when Amy Adams' journalist in Sharp Objects slept with sources, and when Kate Mara's journalist in House of Cards slept with sources, and when Katie Holmes' journalist in Thank You for Smoking slept with sources, and, well, you get the idea, right? So, some would say that this is little more than Hollywood adding drama to everything, which is what they do, given that everyone sleeps with everyone in movies and on TV shows. Still, I do find this whole thing kind of interesting and a little bit rich in that the media has turned a story about the defamation of an American hero into a story about how the media is treated unfairly. Don't you think that's a little bit ridiculous, Alyssa?
I'm sorry, it's a movie about the defamation of an American hero that, as its method of defending an American hero, defames a dead woman when it's not even necessary. There are so many things that the Atlanta Journal-Constitution did wrong in their coverage of the Richard Jewell case and in other aspects of its journalism that you don't need to make up a lie that a dead woman was a dumb slut in order to launch your critique of media. I'm sorry, it's a movie that contradicts its core argument in the text of the movie. It's a bizarre thing to do.
I don't think it is that bizarre, and I don't really think it does contradict the core text of the argument.
If the argument is that you don't say unfounded nonsense about people in public,
That's not the text of the argument. The text of the argument is that worshiping authority will get you into a lot of trouble when authority decides to come after you. But we'll get to that in the review of the film. The reason we are talking about this here in this segment instead of later on is because this is a thing that people get angry about on the internet. Here's a question. Here's Peter, I'm going to ask you this question. Do you think that this was a calculated provocation? Do you think that this is something that was possibly added in order to gin up a certain level of controversy? Or do you think it was just lazy screenwriting? Or do you think it's a perfectly fine and acceptable illustration of a character in the movie?
So I think it is, on the one hand, perfectly reasonable to be upset with the movie over its depiction of how this information was transferred. If you read the Vanity Fair article that the movie was based on, and that does a great job of telling the story of Richard Jewell and how he got railroaded, it simply says that the speculation is that the reporter from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution got the information from a close friend at the FBI. It doesn't say anything more than that. And so the movie obviously takes it much further and shows her strongly implying an offer of sex to the FBI agent. And that doesn't appear to have any textual basis in the reporting about what happened and how this all went down. And so I think it's okay to be upset. I think the Journal-Constitution's lawsuit is a mistake. And I also think it's a mistake because in the same way that the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, which won a lawsuit that was filed by Richard Jewell against them because they said everything we published was a fact, was a verifiable fact. When we said you were a person of interest, that was true.
They also waited him out. They kept the lawsuit going until he died, and about 3 years later, everyone just said, "Ah, forget it. We're done with this."
But in the same way that the First Amendment, you know, sort of protects journalism that is true, it also protects the artistic liberties of filmmakers, of storytellers, when they are retelling stories. And there's a very good piece in Slate about this by Robert Richards that just makes this argument that if the General Constitution cares about free speech in the First Amendment, they shouldn't be filing a lawsuit. Instead, what they should be doing is using every possible other avenue to complain about the depiction through counterspeech. And I think this is a sort of fair way of thinking about it, which is that the lawsuit is bad, even if the complaint is right.
Which they have been doing and have been mounting an extremely effective, I think, free advertising campaign for the film. Because this is what's going on right now, is that you have everybody in the world of talk radio and Fox News and elsewhere saying, like, look at these media jerks. They are trying to make themselves the victims here when the victim was clearly Richard Jewell.
But at the same time... This is a rubric in which only one side has to play by the rules, because then if you are targeted by lies like this, any defense you offer makes you, you know, a self-pitying idiot.
Well, sometimes you just got to take your lumps. I think the AJC has to, I don't think
they should sue. I don't think they should sue, but I think the rubric that's like, oh, you're getting trolled because we're lying about you and you care about it, is, I mean, just what is anyone supposed to do in these circumstances? Mm-hmm. I don't know. And more to the point, you know, the Vanity Fair article that this movie is ostensibly based on offers a damning portrait of what the Atlanta Journal-Constitution got wrong and what in their culture led them to publish this story. They were desperate to recover their prestige after their executive editor had been pushed out by Cox Communications. They had an in-house style that was known as the voice of God, that meant that everything had to be a sort of declarative sentence. They could not acknowledge sort of the use of unattributed sources, which, among other things, meant that they were totally falling down on the coverage of AIDS in Atlanta. Kathy Scruggs didn't tape a critical conversation with one of Jewell's lawyers. Like, there are so many concrete examples of how the journalism failed in this case. And Richard Jewell as a movie throws them all out and makes something up instead. It does not address any of these substantial procedural failings that led the paper to do what it did. And when you do that, when you have a wealth of absolutely institutionally damning evidence that you could use and throw it out and make up a story where you call a dead woman a whore, you don't care about critiquing the media. You care about calling a dead woman a whore.
Let me ask. Let's get to the bottom of this. How do you feel about this trope in general?
It's nonsense. It's nonsense.
You think it's nonsense that sometimes people who work in close proximity have sex with each other?
No, but I think it's nonsense to imply that journalism in general is populated by young, attractive women who have no reporting skills other than taking off their clothes. And you know what? I think it's nonsense to suggest that all powerful men are complete idiots who will say anything to a pretty woman who offers them sex.
Can I also just say that I feel like this whole argument is based on a slight misreading of the scene? Insofar as, look, there are two separate complaints you can make here. There's the general complaint of depicting a female reporter sleeping with sources, fine. But then there's a second, more specific complaint that she traded sex for sources, sex for information.
And she negotiates whether or not he's going to tell her information in exchange for sex in the box.
I do not think that is what is going on in this scene. Earlier in the film, you see her dancing with him, kind of getting up close to him. Here's my argument. She just wants to sleep with John Hamm. The John Hamm equivalent. I mean, like, you've got an attractive young lady, you've got an attractive young man, they're together, they're working in close proximity, And then he gives up the information because he wants the name out there. He doesn't care about the sex.
He is
surprised when the sex actually happens.
I don't think
that
He's like, oh, so we're doing this, huh?
I mean, I think it's just a bonus for him, frankly.
His desire to do that is not established at all in the text in the movie. And like,
Of course it is. He's sitting there stewing. He's sitting there stewing about the fact that nobody will let him release the information. And when he gets back to the office, everyone is so mad. That's why he's at the bar drinking. He's like, God, I can't get this information out there. I'm just going to... And then she shows up and she gets it out of him. And then they have sex. He just wants the information out there. She wants the information and also wants sex.
The information also appears, if you read the Vanity Fair profile, to have been spread to other outlets which were more cautious.
And that's hinted at in the movie as well.
The movie does get at a little bit the way that the Journal-Constitution felt a rivalry, in particular with CNN, which is a national news organization based in Atlanta, and felt like they wanted to beat CNN, and so there was a sort of journalistic rivalry here. I want to try and defuse this just a little bit, and suggest an alternative explanation,
okay,
which is that Clint Eastwood likes to amp up drama in true stories by adding stuff that didn't happen, but plays into the prejudices and biases of the story itself. And I will point us back to, we talked about this before, Sully, where Sully is a movie about a hero pilot who got railroaded by the NTSB and was fingered as being a guy who might have really messed it up, even though he was actually the hero.
Mm-hmm.
That effectively never happened.
Yeah.
In fact, he was really well supported by the airline, but he was not a sort of long-term subject of investigation where people thought he really had screwed up. That just didn't happen at all, and it is the central conflict in that movie. And that's what Clint Eastwood likes to do.
But that's exactly what I mean, right? I mean, if what you care about is delivering a stinging critique of how the media works and how it screwed up in this case, you have all of the evidence to do that, right? And you have the way to do it in a really comprehensive way that implicates not just one bad reporter, but not just one news organization, but an entire media culture. And they whiff. They do something else. And that suggests a desire to play into something cheap and ugly and generally, and in this case specifically, as far as we know, untrue, at the expense of the most effective argument.
Can I speculate just a little bit here? No, I'm going to speculate completely wildly.
Speculate.
I have no proof for this, to be clear. This is completely unfounded. But I would not be surprised, I'll say, if Billy Ray was attracted to this story initially. Billy Ray, who wrote Shattered Glass, also wrote and directed Breach, which was about the sort of FBI rooting out a mole. But Shattered Glass, which is by far the best movie and maybe the best kind of popular story ever about journalistic failure. And I would not be surprised if Billy Ray were attracted to this story as a story of journalistic failure, and that over time, some of those elements were removed and altered from the script, and that the story became somewhat less of about journalistic failure and more about elite institutional snobbery and the way that it kind of was interwoven to attack Richard Jewell.
Who knows? But I also think that this is I question whether or not we should do a whole segment on this before the show. I'm going to pull the curtain back just a little bit because I really think we're spending way more time thinking about this as a culture than was thought about at all within the world of the film. It's about a 2-minute scene. It is not played as some sort of like amazing gotcha moment, like this is why Richard Jewell got screwed, is the literal union of the media and the government coming together to get him. I mean, it's like a tossed off thing, and this is why I'm actually very sympathetic to Olivia Wilde and John Hamm's responses to questions about this, because again, within the world of the film, it is not framed as in as a way to say, like, Richard Jewell was done wrong because these two people just wanted to screw. Like, that is, I really don't think that is how the film plays it at all. It is almost incidental to what happens in the scene. Well, I think it's actually entirely incidental.
It literalizes the idea that she is in bed with law enforcement.
Right. This is why I think it actually is interesting dramatically and visually as a piece of storytelling, is that it is like an almost literalization again of that union of the government and the media coming together to screw the little guy, which gets to your point about elite institutions and elite figures looking down on the schlubs like Richard Jewell.
But you know what? Like, this segment is ostensibly about that trope in movies, and I gotta tell you, neither of you will ever have to do your jobs as journalists contending with that
trope.
Totally
fair. Like, this is totally fair.
It is, you know, I don't cover government anymore, but I remember what it was like to be 24 and schlepping up to the Hill and trying to cover House, you know, Oversight and Government Affairs Committee hearings, and, you know, going to work every day and wondering if people aren't going to take you seriously for any number of reasons, because you're young, because you're awkward, or at the end of the day, because, like, someone thinks you're, like, a dumb slut. You know, it's... If it was something that I thought happened persistently... You know, maybe it would be different, but it is always a trope that is used to damage young women, even though the people who really should be indicted by it are the men in power, who are the other half of the equation. And it is, especially in a case like this, when there is a much more wide-ranging case to be prosecuted, I am just exhausted by it, right? And I'm exhausted by it in part because I think it is the thing that keeps Richard Jewell from being a great movie, and it's almost there. And watching Clint Eastwood screw it up in service of just this nonsense is so infuriating as a woman who has to live under the shadow of this and as someone who actually really almost loved this movie.
All right. So what do we think? Is this whole story a controversy or a non-controversy? Alyssa?
Obviously, it's a controversy.
Peter? I do think it's a controversy, especially when you include the lawsuit.
I think it's a non-controversy, and I have to say that I'm a little bit disappointed at all of the slut-shaming of Kathy Scruggs in this. I think, you know, she gets a really bad rap from the people who watch this movie and think that she shouldn't be out there sleeping with John Hamm.
I know this is your brand, but...
Everybody wants to sleep with John Hamm. All right, that brings us to Richard Jewell proper, okay? Setting aside this whole thing, all right, Richard Jewell, I think, is actually a very interesting portrait of a guy who worships authority, and then sees that worshipfulness of authority turned against him when the system decides that he's an enemy. There are scenes throughout the film when Sam Rockwell's lawyer character, who I think is great, Sam Rockwell, who has had a great year, this Jojo Rabbit, the Bob Fosse show on FX, great year for him.
Sam Rockwell has a great movie
has a great,
every time he comes out with a movie.
Sam Rockwell has
never, ever been
every,
bad.
Every year. But he keeps saying to Richard Jewell,
you sure
have
about
to,
that? Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri?
I think that movie has some issues. I think Sam Rockwell's
good
performance
no.
does
right,
not.
Fair. Okay. The lawyer keeps telling him, shut up. For your own good, shut up. You have to stop talking to these people. They're not your friends. They're not. And Richard Jewell, played by Paul Walter Newhauser. Am I getting that right?
Paul Walter Hauser.
Thank you. Is throughout the film says, no, but I respect authority. You know, I didn't do it. My innocence will set me free. Obviously, this is nonsense. Jewell, of course, he's the guard who saved countless lives by spotting a nail bomb before it exploded at the 1996 Olympics, only to see his life turned inside out by the unholy coupling of the media and the federal government. You know, in your review, Peter, you made a very interesting point that Richard Jewell is what it might look like if the Hollywood's if the default setting in Hollywood was right leaning, right, instead of left leaning. Tell us a little bit about that.
So this is an exceptionally well-crafted movie. I mean, I just don't think anybody can make an argument that this is a badly made or sloppily made movie, with the perhaps exception of that one scene. If it was unthinking, I do think that that's a little bit sloppy. But this is just a really well-made movie in every way. The script is so tight and so precise. Does just a great job of take sort of providing a guided tour of elite institutional failure, starting with academia, because Richard Jewell had been a police guard on a campus, and he had had some run-ins with the administration there, and the administration was who reported him to the FBI. And then you have the media, which jumped, rushed to judgment, published his name, arguably before they should have, even though he was at least a person of interest at that point. And then you have the FBI, which pursues this case in an incredibly deceptive way, and then, you know, it has this theory that he must have done it, and then when the facts don't prove that, they just invent new stuff, right? They start thinking, well, maybe he, they start with the idea that he fits the profile of the of a lone bomber, and then when it turns out he couldn't have done it himself, well, he's like, well, he had an accomplice, possibly he a homosexual lover who he's bombing. Was that real? Is that a thing?
They suggested that there was a third character who's eliminated from the movie. Yeah. Who they said was his lover, but they like literally pursued this as like it's some weird homosexual love thing.
And it's just such a great example of taking a very complex narrative and rendering it perfectly understandable for an audience, and telling a story that is powerful and empathetic, especially about a about an individual who I think. If a lot of people met Richard Jewell, if you both of you see the movie and if you read the Vanity Fair profile. He's not somebody who a lot of people would think, oh, I just really like this guy and want to be around him. I'm going to be honest. He's like an awkward, he's an awkward guy. He was arrested, charged, I believe, with impersonating a police officer at one point.
Pulled somebody over on the highway.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Really appears to have, at times when he was serving in law enforcement, not done a great done some things that he should not have done. He did actually have a checkered past, and the movie is so good, but it is just deeply embedded with conservative assumptions in a way that you almost never see in Hollywood at all. It is just shot through with conservative ideas about how the world works and about how it should work, and then on top of that, the whole thing is a fairly obvious metaphor for the Trump era, in which it is arguing by kind of it is attempting to transpose our feelings about Richard Jewell, which is that here's a guy who has been dumped on by elite institutions who think he's a rube, and instead he's actually a hero.
That strikes me as total projection. I am terribly, terribly unsympathetic to this argument, and it gets to. A thing we were discussing the other day about the kind of urge to import Trump into every piece of art.
No.
And I don't see, there's no, the only reason this might come up is if you think somewhere in the back of your head that the FBI is messing with Trump in a real way. I think lots of people actually think that, and
that is the argument that's being made by Republicans and Trump supporters every single day. And in fact, the FBI, with the Inspector General report that just came out, showed that the FBI made systematic errors. The argument from the Inspector General report is that there was no anti-Trump plot,
but it was just a huge
number of errors. In fact, very similar to what we see the FBI screwing up.
But given the lead time on how long these things take to make, it's not like the Clint Eastwood sitting there thinking.
But this has been going to
be this.
This has been
be a
going
report
on
coming out
for
right when my movie comes out.
This argument about how the FBI has been inappropriately targeting Trump and how the media has been inappropriately targeting Trump from Trump supporters has been going on. At least since he took office, and arguably since beforehand, in terms of the media. But the Nunes memo that came out in early 2018 basically lays out the IG case somewhat more sloppily, but lays out the IG's case about FBI's failures into investigating Trump and the Russia stuff. And so this is a conservative idea that has been in circulation for a couple of years ago now, long enough, I think, for it to inform what is going on in the movie.
At the same time, though, I think one of the reasons that the movie has stuck with me and why. You know, I can't bring myself to sort of disavow it, despite how frustrated I am with it, is that it works in a way that's sort of interestingly politically unpredictable. It says something that we're this far into this conversation, we haven't talked about Kathy Bates in this movie, which says something about how good Sam Rockwell is, how good Paul Walter Hauser is, etc. But there's this scene towards the end of the movie that is real, where Bobby Jewell, Richard's mother, gives a press conference and basically begs President Clinton to intercede in this catastrophe that's befallen their family. And I was watching it, and, you know, she's saying, I hope that nothing like this ever happens to anyone again. And obviously, it has happened over and over and over again, because we have developed both technology and norms that make this possible on a much smaller...
And not specifically to Donald Trump, just like... To, like, lots of people. I mean,
exactly.
Yes, this is an argument libertarians have been making about the FISA process, about FBI investigation.
Well, sorry. I mean, when I'm talking about the technology and the norms, I'm talking about, like, public shaming and the sort of picking apart of people in public in general. And so it's an incredibly tragic scene, because you know that her plea is going to fall on deaf ears. And it's doubly tragic because, first, you know that her hope that this will never happen to anyone ever again will just be crushed over and over in the decades since. But then also, it's tragic because you cannot imagine anyone appealing to the president in the same way today. I mean, yes, you have, like, you can imagine Kim Kardashian going to the White House and lobbying for clemency for some people. But the idea that, you know, this ordinary woman who worked in a call center and had her baby tapes and her underpants stolen by the FBI could get up there and expect the president of the United States to restore decency is just almost an incomprehensible image today. And that's why I don't necessarily see it as, like, a purely Trumpian movie, because it genuinely, I mean, it's an appeal to values that are not accessible anywhere today.
Well, Eastwood has always been more of a libertarian than a conservative. It is worth noting. He, you know, the American Sniper is, I think, like, the most conservative anti-war film I can remember having been made in recent memory. For as conservative as it is, it also has deeply skeptical at the idea of sending these guys back. And then you get kind of the same thing with Sully, which is about the bureaucracy and totally invented.
And it's very much in Richard Jewell, the character, Watson Bryant, his lawyer. It sits in front of a bumper sticker, a sign on his walls that says, I fear the government more than I fear terrorism. But it's explicit in the Vanity Fair piece where, like, it opens with Watson Bryant telling the reporter, I am not a Democrat because they want to take your money. I'm not a Republican because they take your rights away. I think everyone ought to have the right to be stupid. I am a libertarian.
Right. So, I mean, like, it's an incredibly libertarian movie more than a conservative movie, which, again, is I think undercuts the idea that this is a pro-Trump movie, because I know the libertarians are not super fond of Trump either. And I don't think Clint Eastwood himself is.
There's a variety. I would say that libertarians are not universally pro-Trump, but there are very strong supporters of the president in the libertarian world, and also very strong critics and a lot of people who are in between.
How do you guys... So one of the things that really struck me about this movie is the way that the story lends itself to Clint Eastwood's sort of anti-style, that it is a very kind of plain, straightforward looking film. There's nothing fancy here. There's nothing. I mean, the most stylized shot is the kind of dream sequence where he goes into Richard Jewell goes back to the Atlanta bombing and
more shades of Sully.
But even like, exactly. Kind of like Sully. I don't know. What do you guys make of that? I have always kind of been hesitant on Clint, because I do think he is, for an auteur, he is like the least stylish auteur that exists. But I don't know. What do you guys think?
I think it kind of works here in part because you have such a match of person and style, right? I mean, as we've talked about earlier, Richard Jewell died of diabetes related complications at 44.
He was not a healthy man.
But
even before all this,
he was sort of a plain person, right? I mean, he was, at the time of the bombing, he had been fired from this job at this college, and was living with his mom, sort of trying to get his life back together. You know, there's a sort of repeated through line about how the FBI takes, you know, Bobby Jewell's Disney tapes and her Tupperware, and then returns the Tupperware with, like, evidence numbers written on it and marker, and
which is true.
Yes. There's literally a line in that Vanity Fair piece about all of the cleaning methods she tried to get the Sharpie off and couldn't do it. And, you know, I think there is something the movie might have felt sort of sentimental and gross if it had bathed the Jewell family in this halo. It might have felt, you know, kind of contradictory if it had tried to make them more glamorous or good looking than they really are. I mean, and one of the great ironies of this movie, Jay Leno said in 1996 that Richard Jewell looked like someone who had one of the guys who put the hit on Nancy Kerrigan. And Paul Walter Hauser actually played Sean Eckhart, who was one of the people who literally did that in I, Tonya. You know, I mean, there is a plain quality to the people in the movie. I mean, even Sam Rockwell's lawyer was sort of down on his heels. He'd kind of blown up his career. He was working as a solo practitioner. And so the filmmaking and the people match for once in a way that I think works really well.
I think it works pretty well. And I think it's actually a mistake to say that Eastwood doesn't have a style. It's just that his style isn't nearly as flashy as others. He always shoots in a, or nearly always shoots in a very muted color palette. He likes somewhat longer takes. He likes close-ups that allow actors to show their feelings on their faces. And you just get so much out of his actors by the way he shoots them. And he's also, when he wants to be...
He definitely shoots like an actor. This is a thing you see in a lot of...
But he also shoots like an director. He also shoots like an editor. And if you compare this movie, one of the things that stuck out to me, the bombing sequence, we know how it turns out. There's no surprises there. It is played almost exactly as it happened in real life, and yet it is incredibly tense. I found myself actually gripping my chair seat, like kind of almost unable to look at the screen because it's so tense. And you see the same thing in some of the sequences in American Sniper, where it's not even so much. Yes, there's a little bit more uncertainty about exactly how it's going to turn out in American Sniper, but he is a remarkable shooter of tension, of sort of suspense sequences, not big. Sort of blow them up action sequences, you know, like Michael Bay, but of these suspenseful sequences that are then incredibly well edited. And to say that this is a non-style, yes, it's not as flashy as even as Steven Spielberg, but it is clearly identifiable. It's consistent and it's really effective.
Well, an anti-style can be a style. I mean, you're having a kind of straightforward, look and movement to this sort of thing is not a bad thing. I'm not criticizing him exactly, but
think about that scene in which the FBI asks Richard Jewell to say the words that the bomber said when he called it in.
There's a bomb in Centennial Park. You have 30 minutes.
And so this is a real thing that happened once again. And they tried to get him to do this, and it looked like the movie implies, as the Vanity Fair piece does, that what they were doing was they had him say it a whole bunch of times, hoping to get him to say it one way, right, that would be the way that sounded pretty close to how the bomber actually said it, rather than just how he would normally say it. And when this happens, the light goes down. The it suddenly gets very sort of intimate and close, right? And this very subtle thing, it almost becomes black and white, and you see his face not quite in silhouette, but it becomes super shadowed, right? And this is just happening in his living room. It's not like suddenly they went into a super dark interrogation room. It's that he has subtly changed the lighting character of the scene and of the shot in a way that reflects the intensity of it. This is a guy who's actually a masterful and impeccable stylist. It just doesn't come out in the same way that it does with other directors.
I also think that one sort of underrated thing that Eastwood does extremely well that I think liberal watchers of his movies maybe don't give him credit for is he's incredibly good at creating space for male characters to be vulnerable. There's a scene towards the end of Richard Jewell where Richard is sitting in a diner with his lawyer, and the FBI comes and gives his lawyer, not him really, a letter that says that he basically that he's been exonerated. He's no longer a target. And he, you know, Richard is someone who is really, like, he's held himself together remarkably well. And he picks up a donut and just, like, clearly starts to sob, but doesn't let the noise out for a while. And it's the kind of scene that, again, could have tipped over so easily into just making him, like, a ridiculous crying fat boy, right? And Eastwood does not do that at all. You see how scared he is, how much he's been holding everything together. And it's the same with the scene towards the end of American Sniper, where Bradley Cooper's character, Chris Kyle, is back stateside, but has not gone home to his house and calls his wife from a bar and starts to cry in the bar. And so he says, I'm ready to come home. And she hasn't known until that moment that he's in the United States. And once again, I mean, it's, you see how scared he is. He can't even let his wife see him cry, right? I mean, he is so terrified. And so this person, you know, this character whose nickname is literally Legend, is just sort of falling apart. And Eastwood is, because he is so interested in and comfortable with masculinity, I think he manages to create an unusual amount of space for authentic emotional expression by his male characters in a way that filmmakers who I think are sometimes more invested in kind of explicitly opening up space for a wider range of male expression don't always do as well.
He does have a good feel for stoicism, I think, and the way that that kind of breaks down at a certain point. All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up, thumbs down?
Thumbs up. I think, I mean, it is such a frustrating movie. The damage it does is even more to Kathy Scruggs than to sort of itself as an artistic and political project, and yet I still think it's extremely well made and worth seeing, and people should go. Also, Paul Walter Hauser is just great. He's just great in it.
Very good. Very
I mean, all the performers are the lead performers are all just really excellent. I will give it a hesitant thumbs up. Like I said in my review, I'm not actually sure whether it's a great movie, but I kind of think it is. It's certainly one that has stuck with me.
I give it a unhesitant thumbs up. I have, as I've said before, I have always been a little bit skeptical about this Clint Eastwood hero cycle, this American hero cycle. American Sniper works more than it doesn't, but when it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And I think Sully is like actually kind of bad now, the more I think about it. But this is a, I think, pitch perfect, very well done, immaculately performed, immaculately framed and shot and lit, as you mentioned, Peter. I just think it's actually very good. So finally, we move to assigned viewing. Alyssa, what are we watching this week to get ready for the final entry in the Skywalker saga?
Just as a media cycle about it blows up with the actors and directors all saying sort of shady things about each other, we are watching Rian Johnson's The Last Jedi to prepare for The Rise of Skywalker, coming soon to a theater near you.
The Last Jedi. What was this movie about? I forget. What happened in this? What was going on?
Yeah.
Remember when everybody fought about this movie for like a year because
and
they
now
weren't
they're
done
all doing it again
because they
they're
weren't done arguing about the 2016 election. They really wanted to keep that going. Alyssa, why are we? Let's talk about The Last Jedi.
So we're setting up for what is ostensibly supposed to be the last movie in the 9-movie Skywalker cycle, and you know this was a movie that inspired any one of a number of fierce takes, from this is ridiculous and a betrayal of the Star Wars tradition, this is overly really complicated, to you're all racist for not liking these characters, to what the hell are we doing on this casino planet anyway. I think that really the only thing that matters about this movie, and the one fact that can unite Americans, is that Adam Driver is fantastic as Kylo Ren, and is sort of
He's
the
great.
One part of this cycle that has worked at all. But rewatching this movie, it feels genuinely bizarre to me, because there is a good sort of three-hander that is Driver's Kylo Ren, Daisy Ridley's Rey, and I think she, for a part that's sort of deliberately underwritten in some weird ways, she's quite good at it, and then Mark Hamill's disaffected Jedi,
Cranky
Luke Skywalker. And there is like, there's an sort of an excellent like 89-minute movie in there.
Yeah.
And then it is just surrounded by incredibly forgettable nonsense. And this is the rare movie where I feel like most of the time when people watch a movie and like or dislike it, I can sort of understand the opposing point of view. But I cannot understand people who are like, fervent champions of like the Finn and Rose storyline,
yeah.
Or like Finn and Rose as characters at all.
Nobody, you guys nobody, didn't love when Benicio del Toro showed up to explain how bad the military-industrial complex is.
What's fascinating about this film to me is, as you mentioned, Alyssa, there are basically two movies here. There are two movies here. The first movie is I have always kind of liked the Luke Kylo Rey storyline.
It's really good.
I thought that's really good. I thought they were all very good in it. And I like what Johnson was trying to do with the idea of moving away from the Skywalkers. One problem with this is that you need to do that at the in the third movie of the trilogy.
You mean the one titled The Rise of Skywalker?
Right. Exactly. You can't do that. You can't do that at the end of the second installment. That like negates the whole
Skywalkers are over. Yeah. Movie three, wow. Never mind.
We got some more Skywalkers here.
Asterisk.
We're rebooting the Skywalkers.
But I have a hard time with the people who hate it more than anything in the whole world. I don't love it, but I also think that there's enough good in it to say, like, okay, yeah, some of this stuff works.
Yeah.
And the people who love it and insist it's the best Star Wars movie ever, and anybody who doesn't like it is a racist or a sexist. And what was very interesting about when this movie came out, I remember, Alyssa, you like kind of like throwing your hands in the air and being like, it's not just racists and sexists who don't like this movie. I don't like this movie because it has all of these structural problems.
Yeah.
And like it is again, this is why The Last Jedi will always inextricably be linked to the 2016 elections in ways that are like actually toxic, more toxic than the toxic fandom, which we'll get to in a minute, I think, here. Peter, what was your takeaway upon watching it again?
My feeling about this movie continues to be that it has the both the highest highs of the Disney-era Star Wars films and the lowest lows. Everything on the Casino Planet is just awful.
Anybody who craps on the prequels is not allowed to cheer the Casino.
Not just the storyline, but actually the effects work is really bad. I mean, it just looks like crap in a way that a zillion-dollar, no expenses spared, Disney mega movie should not look like crap.
Yeah.
The stuff between, like Eliza said, the stuff between Kylo Ren and Rey and Mark Hamill and Luke Skywalker is actually quite good. The throne room sequence is probably the best action sequence in the Disney era, and maybe I think you could make a case for it being the best action sequence in Star Wars, in all of the Star Wars movies, all throughout. There's maybe some other contenders there. It's not quite as emotionally powerful as some of the stuff from the original trilogy.
I assume we're not including the two assaults on the Death Stars, which are excellent in a different sort of way.
Those are dogfight scenes, not action.
So
scenes.
I would call them action sequences, and I think it is comparably good to the assault on the Death Star in A New Hope, which remains just an incredible piece of filmmaking, absolutely riveting when you watch it again today. And so it has all these great highs, these really big moments, and some great character relationships, and it doesn't quite pay them off. It doesn't quite know what to do with them, and it intersperses them with a bunch of just kind of with some of the worst and dumbest stuff of the Disney Star Wars era. And then the other problem with this movie is that for all the good things that it does, none of the good things that it does are the things that the prior film set it up to do. And this is a lot of what seems to be the implicit kind of criticism coming from the cast and crew of The Last Skywalker, is that, oh, this is the movie that's going to pay off on the promise of the first of these films, which is kind of saying that the second one didn't. And it's just a weird movie that in which Rian Johnson is like, all that stuff you thought you were getting from the J.J. Abrams film, actually, I'm gonna tell you it doesn't matter. You shouldn't care about it, and like you're kind of dumb for being a fan who thinks that that's what that like we should continue along with those.
Alyssa, should we talk about the like response from the cast?
Can I say one thing about it first? But there's also just a more fundamental problem than mythology or anything else, which is that this trilogy of movies is meant to set up a new trilogy of characters, and only one of those characters works at all as a character. And that's Daisy Ridley's Rey. This is a movie.
You think she works better than Kylo Ren?
No.
She's not. She's the only one of the kind of main protagonist trio.
Sorry, I'm talking about Finn, Poe, and Rey.
Oh,
like Kylo, like stipulated, asked and answered. Kylo Ren is fantastic, but Finn and Poe are just like complete non-entities as characters. And part of the strength of the initial Star Wars movies is that you didn't have long exposition scenes, but you got a sense of who these characters were immediately, right? Like, mm-hmm. you knew Leia was, like, a princess from a pacifist planet. She was on the sort of this diplomatic mission. No, there's...
Pacifist planet.
Fine! We can deal with your bugbears later. but you knew all of these things. I mean, you had all of these details sort of sketched in about Han Solo, again, from that first scene. And maybe you can have one character, Finn, who's like, I mean, he's a clone, right? So, like, he has
no... he's a kidnapped child soldier.
He's like, okay, whatever he is. But, like...
Yeah, exactly. That's how much we know about him.
Right. And we know less about Poe. Like, I'm sorry, Oscar Isaac is one of, like, should be one of the greatest actors of his generation. Like, they should be giving him, you know, Kylo Ren-level material in this movie. He is fantastic. These movies are a waste of Oscar Isaac. They've made Oscar Isaac bad.
Well, his whole arc...
They made him irrelevant.
His whole arc...
that's even worse.
His whole arc in this movie is shut up and obey orders. I mean, that is, like, literally the whole point of Poe Dameron's character in this movie is for somebody to learn to shut up and obey the chain of command. Because if you don't do that, everyone's going to die.
But also, like... that could still be a meaningful character thing, right? Like, you know, if you knew anything about, like, the planet where he comes from, his relationship to his squadron, like, yeah. examples where, like, the chain of command has like, sort of deliberately cultivated this rebel persona in him because it makes him a good commando. Like, but we don't know anything about him.
Yeah.
And so there is just, you know, half of, you know, say, so... there are four protagonists, and half of them are just like a black hole that is consuming what ought to be two talented actors. It's just boring.
The Luke and Leia stuff is not bad, and I know people get sort of grumpy about Mary Poppins Leia, but like actually, I don't mind. The Leia stuff, and you know, I really like the way that it kind of implicitly sort of returns to the idea that midichlorian counts matter. Because that's in the end. That's like Mark Hamill is a stronger Jedi than anybody else because, right? Because Luke Skywalker, because he's got
the midichlorians. So you're excited for the return of the midichlorians.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping
that's what you're here for.
The Rise of the Skywalker is a movie about who has the highest midichlorian count,
like a Dragon Ball Z episode where they're like going on their power scanners. He's at 9,000.
It's gonna be like Destiny, where you've just leveled up your character to a certain point, and it's like in the end, the level 47 character with a higher light level wins.
Alyssa, do you want to briefly talk about what is going on with the cast and crew kind of throwing shade at each other?
Yeah,
or
there's been this sort of bizarre news cycle this week where a bunch of the cast from the movie have said essentially that they were just confused about what was happening with The Last Jedi. Anthony Daniels, who plays C-3PO, has been sort of the most outspoken about this, where he says the movie just got too complicated, which I think is not quite accurate relative to the previous movies, but they just sort of didn't get it. And John Boyega has also gotten himself in trouble for saying that the racist harassment that Kelly Marie Tran, who played Rose, got, that it was sort of her fault for letting it bother her. And so it's just been this, it's been very weird to see the cast and crew of what's like ostensibly a highly manicured PR machine due to their prior colleague, what fans are sort of doing to him. It's an odd spectacle.
So given the well-oiled machinery that is the Disney PR apparatus, allow me to suggest that this is not freelancing and it's not just interview exhaustion, but is in fact an attempt to win over a number of the people who have been disillusioned and disaffected by the way the story has gone. I mean, I don't think you have people out there saying, people involved with the movies out there saying, I had no idea what was going on in The Last Jedi. I disagreed with all these plot points. Or saying like, oh God, we cried with excitement when J.J. Abrams came back. Unless Disney is saying like, it's okay to do this.
Like Clint Eastwood's defamation of Kathy Jewell, this is intentional.
No. I'm being
Sonny always suspects a plot.
Hoisted on your own petard.
There's a very good chance that somebody somewhere in the Disney machine is looking at the excitement numbers on this movie, which, according to all available like Google Trends and that sort of thing, are very, very low.
Yeah.
and potentially doing some outreach to the fanboys, fanboys.
It's not just The Last Jedi, it's also Solo. And you have to remember that the last Star Wars movie to come out is the worst received, the lowest box office. And so it's not just that they're coming off of The Last Jedi, which was at minimum controversial, and didn't make as much money as they thought, but was still an incredibly successful movie in a lot of ways. They're coming off of Solo, which was an actual bomb that was a huge disaster
Solo,
in the production.
I have long argued that Solo is the Mission Impossible 3 of these movies, which is that Mission Impossible 3 tanked at the box office because everybody hated Mission Impossible 2. It wasn't a reflection of the relative quality of Mission Impossible 3, just that, you know, and the series has gotten more, you know, better box office results since then. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. Okay.
Either way, it's J.J. Abrams' fault.
The only solution is to bring back the Star Wars expanded universe.
Oh, God. Speaking of bugbears. All right, that's it. That is it for Assigned Viewing this week. Assigned Viewing for next week is Pain and Gain, which we are watching to prepare for Michael Bay's new masterpiece, Six Underground. Very excited for this. We are all big fans of Pain and Gain here. So that is it for Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Rebeller. Please go to rebellermedia.com and sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. Alyssa might be happy with that. So, you know, if you want to make her happy, don't sign up. But if you want to make me happy and let me keep torturing her, keep coming back.
Libertarians are always happy.
If you loved it, tell your friends and review us at Apple. We need those reviews, people. And if you didn't love it, complain to me on Twitter, @SunnyBunch. I will convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sunny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sunny Bunch and Natasha Passetta. Executive producer, Dallas Sonier. Associate producer, Jessica Safavamare. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sunny Bunch, with music by James Malone.